Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the United States and China become such inseparable trade partners? And did our earliest relations with China shape the development of both countries? The first American ship bound for China set off just months after the end of the Revolutionary War, when the U.S. was finally free to trade directly with the Far East. And as my guest today will tell us, the goods and money exchanged between the two countries helped spark significant growth in the U.S. economy, even as human rights and the environment sometimes paid a steep price. The new book by author Eric J. Dolan is called When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. Eric, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Talk about the restrictions that were placed on U.S. trade with China during the times of colonial control by the British.
Well, prior to the American Revolution, the British East India Company had a virtual monopoly over all Far Eastern commerce. And thus, American colonists were restricted from making any trips directly to China. And this posed a kind of a problem for the Americans, because although they received a lot of Chinese goods from the British East India Company, Americans sort of wanted to go to China as well. They had grown, they'd had a love affair with things Chinese from the mid-1600s up through the eve of the Revolution. Tea, silk, and porcelain had been coming over, brought by the British East India Company, but that monopoly squelched any dreams that any American merchants might have had of making a trip on their own.
Of course, the Americans, because their exposure to China had largely been through these sort of exotic luxury goods that depicted really idealized scenes of life in China, we had a not particularly realistic picture of what things would be like there.
Yeah, it was a very abstract version. There was not a lot of information that was provided in the 1500s, 1600s, and 1700s about China to America. A lot of what Americans thought were the things that they saw in these porcelain products and the paintings and other things that came over, which, as you said, were idealized versions of China as this very green, wonderful, verdant habitat, you know, place for people were,
So they arrived, and in some cases were sort of disillusioned by the fact that, oh, it's real life here.
Yeah, well, they didn't have a lot to go on, but after the American Revolution ended and the Americans started venturing to China, they started to develop their own imagery of China based more on personal experience rather than abstract depictions of China and Chinese culture as derived from European sources or the objects themselves that came over.
So, Eric, tell us about that first trade mission by this ship called the Empress of China, which became sort of a symbol of our newly independent ambitions.
Yeah, this was a great voyage. It began on February 22nd, 1784. The main person behind this voyage was Robert Morris, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and the man who had earned the moniker Financier of the Revolution for his Herculean efforts to fund the war effort. He also had been a merchant during the war and had outfitted a lot of privateers and made a minor fortune doing that, plundering British shipping. And after the war, he was looking for other business opportunities, and China represented a tantalizing opportunity for him. So he and some other backers put together this voyage, and on February 26th, the Empress of China slid down the East River on its way to Canton. And it was a particularly auspicious day because on that very same morning, another ship, the Edward, was heading to London. And on board the Edward were the definitive articles of peace. So this coincidental departure of these two ships provided an historical juxtaposition that could have been conjured by a novelist, because the Edward was truly announcing to the world with this birth certificate on board the arrival of the newest nation. And at the same time, the Empress of China was making its own statement that America was here to compete on the international arena of commerce. And that wasn't the only dramatic aspect of February 22nd, because this was also the day on which George Washington had his 52nd birthday. And although that was just a coincidence, he couldn't have asked for a better birthday present than the coincidental sailing of these two ships, which expressed such hope for America's future.
So tell us a little bit about what conditions were like those days when you had to cross half the world to get to your destination, because it was not only did it take a long time, it was really dangerous work.
Right. Well, keep in mind, this is a time when they didn't have GPS. They didn't have good charts in many instances of the places that they were going. The Americans, although excellent mariners and very familiar with the waters in the Atlantic Ocean, they were very unfamiliar with the waters beyond the Cape of Good Hope, and that's the route that the Empress of China took on its way to Canton. And so they didn't have particularly great charts. They had rough ideas of where they were going, but they were able to navigate using stars and coming close to land on occasion. But fortunately for the people on the Empress of China, when they got to the most dangerous part of the voyage, near Java and heading into the South China Sea, where the waters were infested by upwards of 70,000 Chinese pirates, there was a providential hand given to them. They knocked into three French ships. The French had already been trading with China for many years, and one of these ships, the Triton, its captain had made 11 prior voyages to Canton. And the French loved the Americans at this time, because this is right after the American Revolution, when, of course, the French had helped us vanquish the British. So they had a great night of drinking, and then the next day they headed off, and the Empress of China was led almost by hand by the French ship all the way to Canton, not only navigating through the torturous shoals and underwater hazards that there might be, but also because the Triton, the French ship, had more than 100 cannon on board, it could fend off any pirates that might try to attack.
And for people not familiar with Canton today, this is Guangzhou in 2012.
Yes, Canton is modern-day Guangzhou.
And what made this such an ideal port to be sort of the center of trade with the West for China?
Well, it was one of the first places that Europeans, prior to the Americans' arrival, a great range of European nations had beat a watery path to China. And the Portuguese were one of the first in the 1500s. And they, one of the first places that you get to when you're coming from Europe, going east to China, the main port is Canton and Macau, which is a little further out. And also Hong Kong is near there as well. So this is one of the first ports where the Europeans contacted the Chinese to begin with. And then the emperor in 1757 decided that a lot of these Westerners were a little bit unruly. They often wanted to proselytize the Chinese to adopt some form of Christianity. When they didn't like how trading was going, they might resort to arms or violence. So the emperor decided it was a good idea to concentrate or keep an eye on these foreign devils, as he referred to them, by keeping them cloistered in this port of Canton. And from 1757 up until the early 1840s, all Western traders who wanted to trade with China had to go to Canton, and there in Canton, they lived in a small walled-off area of the city, just 12 acres in size, where they had their buildings, or factories as they were called, from which they did their business between October and March during the main trading season. And Canton was a wonderful place for the trade to take place, because there were a lot of rivers that fed down south to Canton. There were a lot of easy access ways to get the Chinese goods to the foreigners who were in Canton. There were a lot of skilled tradesmen in and around Canton, and it was a very convenient port for the Europeans as well as the Chinese.
I have to say, Eric, the book is full of fascinating things that I never knew before, but the descriptions that you give of what the protocol was for Americans trading in Canton and how the government sort of regulated things there, it was probably the most fascinating section for me in the whole thing.
Yeah, it was very formalized. When the Westerners first made it into the Pearl River estuary, they had to stop off in Macau, which was sort of like, at this point, in the late 1700s, it was almost a quasi-European outpost. It was populated by a great range of foreigners, including predominantly Portuguese, who had been there the longest. And when the ships got to China, they would stop there. They would go meet with the hapo, or one of the overseers of trading on the Chinese side, and they would get a grandly inscribed chop. They would be allowed sort of a permit to go further up the Pearl River estuary, and go to the mouth of the Tigris, the Boca Tigris, which is the entrance to the Pearl River proper. And there they would have to stop and be inspected again. And they would have to exchange gifts with the local overseers of trade. And there would be speeches about how happy the Chinese were that the foreigners had come to trade and the Americans would return these sobriquets. And then they would get another permit that would allow them to travel further up the Pearl River, where all the Western ships would anchor off Whampoa Island, which is about 10 miles below the port of Canton. And there at Whampoa Island, all the sailors and people who ran the ship would stay with the ship while the supercargo and sometimes the captain of the ship would go further up to Canton to actually conduct the business with these Hong merchants. And the Hong merchants were a small guild of merchants appointed by the emperor, and they were in charge of the foreigners while they were in China. So if the foreigners acted poorly, the Hong merchants could be called to account. And all of the foreigners did their trading primarily through the Hong merchants. And while they were in Canton, it wasn't only the Hong merchant that oversaw their activities. It was a set of regulations, the so-called eight regulations that the emperor had established to keep the foreigners in line. One of them allowed the foreigners only 2 to 3 days per month to venture out of this walled-off area into Canton proper. And during that time, they could only visit botanical gardens and places of worship. They couldn't stay out too late, carouse, or make noise. And another restriction.
You know, let me jump in here, Eric, because this is so interesting, and I want to make sure we have time to talk about it. We need to take a quick break.
Okay.
My guest this hour is author Eric J. Dolan. His new book is called When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. The reason we are breaking now is to let you know, to give you an update on the fall membership campaign. We have 1,666 contributions left to go before we call an end to this, and we are finished and back to full-time regular programming. Thanks to so many of you who have responded to the call of support for KERA. You can do your part now at 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. Jeff Whittington is with us now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We've been encouraging folks to go online to kera.org and make their contribution. You can also share your seven words of encouragement. I call it your seven-word essay about KERA. Faith says, new Texan, new KERA fan, listens daily. Sarah says, broadcasting literate, fascinating, wide-ranging news and opinions. And Will says, I listened before my mom worked there.
So you can nice.
you can join the campaign here as a member. You can also join with your thoughts, your seven words. Go to kera.org, make your contribution, and send us your seven words, or call 888-694-6931. We'd love to send you your very own copy of When America First Met China by Eric J. Dolan. When you join the station today with a $120 contribution or more, that would be a great way to support the station and get a copy of this fascinating book. We'll send it to you with our thanks, and you'll get this great radio station 365 days a year.
This is one of those books that I know those of you in our audience who are history nuts will absolutely eat up with a spoon. It is full of really, really fascinating things and answers questions as to why some things are the way they are even today. So give us a call now at 1-888-694-6931 to reserve your thank you copy or go to kera.org. When you make your contribution, of course, you are paying for the radio that you listen to every day that you have been listening to all this time. Please share the responsibility with your neighbors, with your friends, with your colleagues for ensuring that great public radio is here and alive and well in North Texas.
888-694-6931. Don't forget, your contribution also automatically gets you entered to win an 11-day trip to Australia from Discover Down Under. It's worth $11,000. Somebody's going to win this. We're still looking for 1,666 contributions to wrap up this membership campaign. We can do it today if you'll call or contribute at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Eric J. Dolan. His new book is called When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think at kera.org. Eric, before the break, you were telling us about some of the 8 regulations put in place to sort of keep U.S. merchants and sailors on their best behavior.
Right, and one of the regulations that the Americans bristled at the most was the one that restricted them from bringing any women into this 12-acre enclosure in Canton. Although a few women managed to break the rules and sneak in, and one of the stories that I tell in the book is of Harriet Lowe of Salem, Massachusetts. In the late 1820s, she accompanied her uncle, William Henry Lowe, a partner in Russell & Company, to Canton. She was taking care of her sickly aunt. And it was just great reading her journal, because here is this 20-year-old woman from the United States in this exotic, almost her perception of it before she got there as being almost like a fairyland. But she was kept from going into Canton. And she really railed against these restrictions on her sex, and she wanted to be able to do what men could do, which is just pick up and go where they please. So she started complaining to her uncle and anybody else who would listen. And finally, they agreed to let her dress up as a man, her and her aunt, and they made their way into Canton, the walled-off city. And they spent a couple of weeks there before being discovered, and they were finally ushered out because the Hong merchants said to Mr. Lowe that if you don't get your niece out of here and your wife right away, we will stop trading with you. And that was the ultimate threat that the merchants, the Chinese merchants, could use to any of the foreigners who were operating there. But to read her journal and some of the passages that I include in the book, it's just really exciting seeing how she viewed this strange and, to her, totally alien land while she was there. She was also very excited because she was one of the few single women around, and there were a lot of single, eligible, and apparently, according to her, very good-looking young men about.
Now, talk about why the Chinese, I mean, all this reflects a sort of dim view of foreigners. Why did the Chinese view people from other places coming to Canton with such great disdain?
Well, it goes way back to the origins of the Chinese Empire. The Chinese believed that they were the Middle Kingdom, the Celestial Empire, that the emperor was the son of heaven. So it was basically heaven above the Chinese Empire and everybody else below. And this Sinocentric view of the universe was held very strongly within the empire for thousands of years, and certainly up through the early 1800s when the American trade started to take off. The Chinese referred to foreigners as foreign devils or fankies. They called the English red-haired devils. And when the Americans got there, they called them the flowery flag devils because our flag with the white stars on the blue background looked like flowers in a field. So there was great condescension on the part of the Chinese towards Westerners. And interestingly enough, the Americans, once they got there and got their own look at this little slice of Chinese culture, very warped though it was, just being forced to be in a small area of Canton, they also developed, by and large, a very condescending view of the Chinese. So the disdain was mutual at this point.
But as these things tend to go, both sides had something that the other wanted. Talk about the flow of goods back and forth. I mean, I think we know that Americans wanted silk, they wanted porcelain. What did the Chinese want that the Americans could bring them?
Well, one thing you didn't mention that's really important, of course, is tea. And this number just blows me away. On the eve of the American Revolution, Americans were drinking more than 1 billion cups of tea a year. So in addition to porcelain and soap, but the Chinese from the Americans, the main thing they wanted is the main thing they had been asking of other Western nations for many years, and that was silver, and more specifically Spanish dollars or pieces of 8, the first truly global currency. Because in China, silver was used by the people to pay their taxes. It was used by the government to pay government officials and military officials. It was the currency of the country. And the Chinese had, for a long time, not expressed particularly great interest in a lot of the other goods and manufacturers that Westerners could bring to their shores. So as a result, the British, who were the largest trading partner with China, was sending a virtual flood of silver into Canton every year to pay for the increasing amounts of tea and other goods that they wanted in return. And when the Americans finally showed up, they followed suit. During the first three decades of our involvement with China, roughly 65% to 70% of all of our purchases in Canton were made with silver. So from the very start, we had a trade deficit. We were importing a much greater amount of goods than we were exporting in return. But we did have things that the Chinese wanted. For example, ginseng, which was used as a curative, an aphrodisiac in China. There were Chinese versions or species of ginseng. The Americans found that we had a ginseng here in North America. We brought that over. We brought other things that we picked up along the way. The Chinese loved sea otter pelts. When Captain Cook, the English explorer, went over, was trying to find the Northwest Passage and landed in Vancouver Island, his men traded for sea otter pelts that were brought to Canton, and in some cases traded for upwards of $100 per pelt.
Yeah, the profit margins on these things were extraordinary.
Extraordinary. When that information got back to the United States and the Americans got involved in the sea otter trade, and we almost monopolized it by the early 1800s, there was a constant stream of sea otter pelts heading to Canton and, in effect, paying for all the goods that we wanted in return. Also, seal skins was another big object of desire on the part of the Chinese, as well as sea cucumbers, or what was called bêche de mer at the time. The Chinese liked to use dried sea cucumber to flavor soup, and they also, it was supposedly very useful in rejuvenating the body and enhancing sexual prowess. And on that point, I have to mention that there are a huge number of things that the Chinese ate that purportedly enhanced sexual prowess. I don't know what it is, or if they were just having a lot more fun than the rest of us. But when you read history, there are so many different objects that were related to increase in sexual prowess. It was just amazing. Another item that went over from America, which played an important role in our trade, was sandalwood. Sandalwood has within it a fragrant oil that the Chinese loved, and they used the wood to make aromatic furniture and also to produce incense that could be burned in houses of worship. And the Americans went to Fiji, to Hawaii, to the Marquesas, and in conjunction with the natives who were paid muskets and sperm whale teeth and other trinkets in exchange for their labor, they brought hundreds of thousands of tons of sandalwood to Canton. And one of the most interesting transactions was with King Liholiho of Hawaii. The Americans knew that this king and his father, Kamehameha, loved American ships and would trade sandalwood for American ships. So the very first ocean-going yacht built in the United States, the Cleopatra's Barge, built by George Crown and Shield in Salem, Massachusetts, 1816, that was bought by a China trader and brought over in 1820 to Liholiho to entice him to trade for sandalwood. And he bit. He traded 500 tons of sandalwood for this beautiful ship. It lasted about 4 years when, in a supposedly alcohol-fueled jaunt around the islands, Cleopatra's barge was crashed into the rocks of Kauai. But so there were a number of different goods that Americans brought over besides silver. But silver was really the big one for the first number of decades, and then it was replaced by letters of credit from British banks and sort of paper money that they brought to Canton. So for the entire trade that I talk about, the Americans were forced to use financial instruments of one sort or another to purchase the goods they desperately wanted.
You know what surprised me on the trade going the other direction, Eric? I did not expect to read that back in the early days of U.S.-China trade, much like illicit drugs today, tea, real Chinese tea, was often cut with lesser materials to make it go farther.
Yeah, that story surprised me as well. What happened is unscrupulous Chinese and British merchants would add all sorts of unpleasant substances to tea to make it go farther and, unfortunately for the consumer, taste worse. These adulterants, they were called smooch, and they included dried leaves of other plants to add bulk. They also could use iron filings to add weight because tea was sold on a weight basis. But one recipe for smooch that I read about, an English recipe that was particularly disturbing, required taking ash leaves, drying them, baking them, then stomping them, then soaking them in a solution of sheep's dung and ferrous sulfate, then drying them once again and remixing them with tea leaves to be sold to the unwary consumer. Fortunately, we have much stricter regulations today, and I wouldn't worry so much when you take a sip of tea, but there are a lot of strange things in addition to human sweat, because a number of the images in the book show the last stage of preparing the tea for transport, and that was when Chinese men, barefoot, would literally stomp on the tea leaves in these crates to pack as much tea as possible into each crate.
Well, it makes sense that we drink a lot more coffee today than tea. Eric J. Dolan is my guest. He's the author of the new book, When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. We'll come back to our discussion with Eric in a few minutes, and we invite you to join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. If you are interested in reading Eric's new book, When America First Met China, and it is time for you to make a contribution to KERA, we can let you do both at the very same time. Go online to KERA.org or call in to 1-888-694-6931. Among the thank you gifts we have available at the $120 level or above is a copy of When America First Met China. We also, Jeff Whittington has joined me now, Jeff. Mm-hmm. We have a limited number of pairs of tickets to Cirque du Soleil, which are also available with a $120 contribution. You get two tickets to Kuza, this new show that you and I and our respective spouses both saw. It was fantastic. And the show is Friday, the October the 19th, that you can get tickets to.
Friday the 19th at the Big Top down near Reunion Tower in the Dallas Convention Center. So that's available with a $120. So call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. We heard from Kate McCrory in Dallas, who says a contribution to KERA will give me so much more pleasure in the next year than anything I could buy at the mall.
What a nice thing to say.
Kristen Scholler and Zach Hayward in Irving said, KERA keeps me informed and educated. Becca and Tom Supin in Fairview sent in their seven words. I listen every day. My kids complain. I also want to thank David Overton in Dallas for his contribution. Please be the next one to call or contribute online. Chris, we are counting down to the end of the drive, the end of our 7-day, 7,000 contribution drive, and today is the seventh day.
We are definitely counting down. We have 1,650 contributions yet to go. You have made it go very quickly so far. We would hate to get hung up on the last 1,650. Make your contribution now. Prove to the folks who plan these things that a 7-day drive is a great thing to try every time, right? Because if we get there, then we can be finished with fundraising, get back to the coverage that we know you love. We are in an election season, of course. We know it's very important to you to get back to full-time news coverage. I've said this before, but I really think the cost of a KERA subscription is worth, if nothing else, just the fact checks that you get on NPR, on the things, the statements that candidates make and whether or not they are true, partially true, not at all true. Those things are wonderful. But then you also have shows like this one, like Fresh Air with Terry Gross, like the Diane Rehm Show, that almost are like little magazines that you can consume while doing other things, right? You can take them when you go exercise. You can have them in the car with you, at home when you're running errands. We know lots of you listen at work, and we're delighted by that. You can listen to KERA anytime. We are here for you all the time because people just like you say, hey, public radio is an important value for a community, and I'm going to give a little bit of money or a lot of money to keep it strong.
Yeah, it is election season, and Chris, I think fact check is going to be the word of the 2012 campaign. Even the campaigns are now saying they're going to fact check each other. Mitt Romney said he would fact check the president in the debate. The debate is 6 days away, the first debate. So we want to wrap this drive up as soon as possible so that we can bring you uninterrupted analysis, uninterrupted reporting, uninterrupted information about what's going on in the election campaign, because hey, the election is just 5 weeks from Tuesday. So it's time to make your contribution right now at 888-694-6931. Be one of the ones. Your call will take us from 1,650 contributions remaining to go to 1,649, and then the next one's 48, and let's see, you see how it works. And then your contribution online at KERA.org, your act in support of KERA, will make this reality and make this drive wrap up.
We have some more words from people. Judith says, it's worth my time to listen to. Thank you, Judith. Michael says, I support the University of Public Radio. What a great way to look at it. We want to thank also Gene Larson in Dallas, Nathan Church in Mansfield, and Paul and Marty Sampson in Terrell. Really appreciate your support. We know, you know, that we wouldn't be here if not for people like you who decide to make public radio part of their financial portfolio. Think about your money to KERA as really an investment in your own education and understanding of the world.
And whatever you can give is great. Whatever you can invest in a station that you already use, a station, a service you rely on is great. Some people choose to give a little bit more. Maybe you could consider increasing your contribution level. Maybe you could consider becoming a friend of KERA. The Friends of KERA, it's a $1,500 annual contribution to the station. It'd be a really great time right now to be able to hear from some folks. Maybe it's time for you to renew your Friends membership. Maybe you joined as a friend last year, or you renew in the fall. Well, you can do that right now by calling 888-694-6931. You can do it online at kera.org, and that will help us get to the end of this drive just like every other contribution will.
Let us know that you support KERA with a contribution of $120, and you can choose either a copy of Eric J. Dolan's beautiful new book, When America First Met China, or you can choose a pair of tickets to CUSA, the new Cirque du Soleil production that is down right below Reunion, the Reunion Tower. There's a show that is going on Friday, October 19th, and we do have pairs of tickets, although a limited number, available when you make a contribution of $120 or more. So let us know about your love of public radio, your support for KERA now by going online to kera.org or by calling in to 1-888-694-6931.
And your contribution automatically enters you as well to win the Discover Down Under 11-day, $11,000 value Australia trip. We're not giving away Australia, but we are giving away a trip to Australia, and you have a chance to win when you make your contribution at kera.org or by calling 888-694-6931.
Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Eric J. Dolan. His new book is called When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Eric, let's talk about the drugs here. A lot of people are aware of the demand for opium in China in the 18th and 19th centuries. Talk a little bit about the role that Americans played in that trade.
Well, the Americans came in on the heels of the British, and I have to spend just a minute on that because they sort of unlocked the secret of opium being able to reverse the flow of silver from the West to China and out of China. Because as the British, as the largest trading partner with China, was hemorrhaging silver towards the end of the 1700s. Already, opium, mainly from India, but also some from Turkey, was being brought in to China, where the Chinese were increasingly smoking the drug. But the opium itself was prohibited in China. The emperor forbade it being brought into the country. So smugglers got involved, Chinese smugglers, and the Chinese smugglers paid for the drug in silver. So the more drug that the British brought in, the more silver that was paid in return that they could use to buy their goods. And eventually, towards the beginning of the 1800s, the flow of silver that had been going from Britain to China reversed course. And right about that time, when the Americans started to get involved in the opium trade, first In the early 1800s, they brought opium from Turkey, which was of a lesser grade than the opium from India, and the Chinese still purchased it, but they often used it to mix with the better opium to make it go a little bit further. The Americans, however, were relatively minor players, and that's not discounting what they did. They were very involved. They were involved in the trade, but whereas the British could be bringing anywhere from 20, 30, and towards the end of the 1830s, almost 40,000 chests of opium to China a year, the Americans in their best years would bring 1,000 or 1,500 chests of opium. And keep in mind, in each one of these chests was about 130, maybe 140 pounds of opium. And the Americans earned a lot of money from that, sometimes more than $1 million a year. One of the most famous and successful of America's opium merchants was Robert Bennett Forbes out of Massachusetts. And in a single year, he earned $30,000 dispensing opium off the side of a storage ship that was moored in the Pearl River estuary and trading it to the Chinese smugglers, who then would use these very swift boats to shuttle the opium up to Canton or other places along the coast. So the opium trade became phenomenally important, especially for the British. It was also important for the Americans, and to the detriment of the Chinese.
What happened when the Chinese proscription on opium was amended?
When it was amended?
Did it stay illegal forever in China?
Oh, no. It was illegal up through the second of the Opium Wars. The first Opium War started in about 1839. It was largely a result of a clampdown on the part of the Chinese to try to put an end to the opium trade once and for all. And the way in which that clampdown proceeded basically gave Britain, who had long been hankering for a fight to open up China to more trade and to be treated more as they thought they should be treated, not as a potential, like a vassal or tributary nation, but as the powerful nation that they were. This launched the first of the Opium Wars. At the end of the Opium War, they didn't even mention opium in the treaty. It remained illegal to import it into China, but smuggling continued and increased. And a growing flood of opium was making it into the country in the 1840s and 1850s, and that helped to precipitate the second so-called Opium War. Keep in mind, the Americans weren't directly involved in either of the wars, although they were definitely nurturing the drug trade. But at the end of the second Opium War, around 1860, opium was legalized. And the flood of opium into the country increased, and it was also joined by an increasing amount of opium that was being produced in China itself.
So talk about this. Obviously, as trade increased, the flow of people in both directions increased as well. But in the case of Chinese laborers sent abroad, the move was often not voluntary.
Yeah, this chapter of the China trade was one of the most disturbing for me to learn about and to write about. And it was called the Chinese coolie trade. And it was in the mid-1800s. What happened is that since the 1600s, the labor required to run all of the sugar, cotton, and tobacco plantations in Latin America had been provided mainly by African slaves brought over from Africa. But by the mid-1800s, a problem arose. The emancipation efforts and the banning of slavery in many areas restricted the number of African slaves that were available to be sent to Latin America, just at a time when demand for all these plantation-grown crops was increasing. So this created an incentive and sort of launched the coolie trade. The coolies, on paper, were just indentured servants, in a sense, taken from China to Latin America. They would work for a certain number of years under a certain rate of pay, pay off their indentured servitude, and then be free to do what they want, go back to their homeland or maybe stay in the country to which they were brought. But in reality, they were little more than slaves by another name. And in the mid-1800s, about 250,000 Chinese, predominantly men, were taken from China to Latin America to work on these plantations. And they were often tricked to get on board these ships. They were staked money, and they were allowed to gamble. And when they lost that money, the person who lent it to them would say, "You've got to go on this ship to pay off your debt." And it was a horrific life in Latin America. anywhere between 50 and almost 100% of the coolies died before their contract was up.
Wow.
And one of the worst places to go were the Chincha Islands off Peru. There, the Chinese were employed in digging guano, or bird waste. Mountains of guano had been deposited on these islands offshore in Peru. And the Chinese would dig the guano. The guano would then be transported to America and Europe, where it was used as fertilizer for the crops to grow food. And this was a particularly hellish employment of these Chinese, and upwards of 95% of them died before their contract was up. Many of them committed suicide by jumping off these enormous mounds of guano. It was truly a horrific part of the trade. But America was the first Western country to outlaw this coolie trade in 1862. And even though America wasn't the main transporter of coolies, between 1852 and 1862, American ships transported transported tens of thousands of coolies to Latin America, earning millions of dollars for the owners of those ships, who got paid a fee per coolie to transport them south.
And of course, we had slave ships that we had purpose-built for work just like that.
Yeah, slave ships. And also, another connection to the China trade is right when the coolie trade was taking off, from the 1840s to the 1860s, the clipper ship era in America was going full bore. And American clipper ships, these very fast, graceful greyhounds of the sea, were first produced in the early 1840s specifically for the China trade, to get to China as fast as possible, pick up the tea, return as fast as possible, because the fresher the tea, the higher the price that would be paid. When the gold rush came along, these Chinese clipper ships were repurposed and were joined by hundreds of other clipper ships designed to get would-be prospectors to San Francisco as fast as possible, drop them off, then go to China, pick up Chinese goods, and come back to America. But towards the end of the 1850s, the clipper ship era was coming to a close, and a lot of those clipper ships that had formerly been in the China trade were again repurposed and were used in the coolie trade, a truly ignominious end for these ships that are considered to be our proudest sailing achievements in American history.
What do you see as the legacy of this early relationship in our relationship with China today?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that this relationship didn't just start in the last 30 or 40 years. It goes back to the origins of our country. And the thing that was interesting to me in the beginning, Americans mainly looked at China in terms of trade and how we could profit from trading with the Chinese. In many cases, that is still the way that we view the Chinese today. In the early years of the China trade, there was a major trade deficit. There still is a trade deficit today. I find that an interesting parallel. And I think that this dream of Chinese consumption of American goods causing an explosion in our trade is still largely unrealized. In the early years of the China trade, we knew very little about the Chinese and Chinese culture, and a lot of our views were very negative. I think there is certainly a lot of that still today, even though we have much closer connections today than we ever had in the past, and there's a lot of cross-cultural distribution of information. There is still, in many cases, a suspicion on both sides, and a lot of Americans, I think, don't have a deep understanding of Chinese culture, although that's changing. And one thing that I find that's important within that is that even in the early China trade, individual merchants, American merchants, would often establish very warm, close, and respectful relationships with Chinese merchants, such as the Hong merchants. And in speaking with people who do business with China today, I hear a lot of the same stories. Whereas the individuals can develop very strong relationships, a lot of respect and honor passed back and forth, when you back up to the higher level of governments, there still is an awful lot of suspicion, antagonism, and the like. So it's always interesting how people can establish warmer relationships often on a personal basis, but on a national basis, it's there are many other things that intervene. Another lesson, I think, of
you know, Eric, I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to jump in here because we've run out of time. The new book is called When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. Eric, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Thanks to all of you listening this afternoon. We really appreciate your participation in the show. We especially appreciate those of you who are helping us to finish out our fall fundraising campaign. We have 1,627 contributions left to go. We would love to get under 1,600 in the next few minutes, and that's easy to do. It's just you and 26 other people, but all you have to think about is you. Go online now to KERA.org or call 1-888-694-6931. Maybe you would like to read When America First Met China, and you're ready to make a contribution to KERA. We can do that for you if you make a contribution of $120 or more. Hey, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris Boyd. Yes, we've got copies of Eric J. Dolan's book, When America Met China, When America First Met China, available at the $120 or above membership level. Call 888-694-6931 or contribute at KERA.org. That's just $10 a month as a sustaining member. We are out of the Cirque du Soleil CUSA tickets, but I want to thank them for making those available and remind you that that show is going on right now.
It's great.
Through sometime in late October. So, you know, check it out. It's always so amazing what those people do. And, you know, we had one of the stars of the show and the creative director in studio last month before they even got the big top up to talk about the show. So if you like that kind of thing, and even if you don't, you probably will like it.
Even if you don't, you'll like
even
it.
Even if you don't like that kind of thing, you're going to be impressed because it's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable what they're capable of doing. And, you know, it's unbelievable how in-depth we can get into a subject like the one this hour when we had Eric J. Dolan on. So,
You know, this really is a fantastic book. Yeah. Very, very interesting. And it is, there's really good history here, but he throws in a lot of really small details, some of which we obviously couldn't get to in just an hour on the air. But if you like history and if you like sort of a look at historical topics that you hadn't considered before that have not been widely explored, this is a really, really interesting book for you or for the history buff in your life. Of course, you can get it anywhere. We would love for you to get it through us when you make your contribution at 1-888-694-6931 or KERA.org. 1,625 contributions left to go. We're really looking in the next couple of minutes to get 25 knocked down because we'd like to get under 1,600 so that we can start the second hour of Think with that much to go. And you can help us out right now.
Everybody likes a clean round number.
Everybody likes a round number.
Yeah.
The best round number for us is zero.
I like prime numbers. But I'm not going to try to find a prime number up at 1600.
Well, soon we'll be at 1623, and then we'll just
that would
need
be a prime number.
Yeah.
So please be two. Be two people. I'm the king of the nonsensical
non-sequitur
today. Thanks to Judith McGee in Arlington and Michael Dawson in Dallas. Also, Gentry and Alyssa Dotson in Grandview. They have joined. They're part of the reason that there's only 1,625 contributions left to go in this membership campaign. Thanks to Cynthia and Frank Collier in Hazlitt and Kurt Scherf in Carrollton and Roger Boulanger in Plano. Thank you so much to Robin Graham in Carrollton, Therona Ramos in Carrollton, and Karen and Charles Helfert in Dallas.
Thank you also, Kathleen Shaw in Arlington, Shelby Bivens in Plano, Charlene Mahoney in Louisville. Really appreciate that. And we have a comment here from Charlene who says, we listen to NPR every day, and at least once a day, we both start sentences with, quote, I heard on NPR today, with each other and with our friends. Thanks for great thought-provoking programming. Well, thank you so much, Charlene. Greatly appreciate your support of the station.
Prime number.
We know a lot. What's a prime number?
1623 to
1623,
go.
Okay, we're there. But we want to get to 1600 or below. So just make make your contribution now. Make Jeff happy. 1-888-694-6931 is our telephone number. You know, I believe 31 is also a prime number.
Let's go. Let's go. Let's get to 1531.
There you go. KERA.org online.
Hey, Kurt Scherf, whose name I read a minute ago, he gave us a 7-word essay.
All right, let's hear it.
Surviving 4 a.m. with BBC World News.
Very nice. Yeah. I've been there myself, Kurt.
And Gabriel said, yes, we can. pledge your support today.
Very nice. Thank you for all of you who are contributing seven words and also contributing dollars to the station. 1-888-694-6931 is the number, or go online and do it at kera.org. Thank you.